Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Today on Change Surfer Radio, we'll be listening first to a brief editorial by Scott Edelman, the editor of Sci-Fi Weekly, about the uneven distribution of the future. And then we'll be listening to a critique of transhumanism, and me, by the way, by the political scientist Larry Arnhart at Northern Illinois University. He was speaking in Washington, D.C. at the Association for Politics and the Life Sciences meetings, September 1st, 2005. Last week, Scott Edelman, who's the editor-in-chief of Sci-Fi Weekly at sci-fi.com, published an editorial in response to the Katrina catastrophe, which just echoes so eloquently the techno-progressive impulse and thought matrix that's been developing around cyborg democracy and Change Surfer Radio and all the other kinds of endeavors that I've been involved in. So his essay is called The Odds of Being Uneven. Again, this is by Scott Edelman, the editor-in-chief of sci-fi.com, and this is at sci-fi.com. I walk through two worlds, the world that is and the world as it should be. Actually, we all do. I know which one I'd prefer to inhabit, but I don't get to choose, only to dream. Making this sort of observation has become a cliche in science fiction circles by now, so I bet that many of you could fill in the details of my complaints. They go something like this. Where's the personal jetpack I was promised? What happened to those weekend jaunts to the moon that I was supposed to be taking by now? And why haven't robots assumed all the world's menial tasks yet? I'm sure that a review of my past editorials would yield even more carping about the distance between reality and the future in which we were told that we'd be living today. But the fact that the answer to the above questions is sadly, don't hold your breath, isn't my point today. Nor am I here to talk about the flip side of that issue, which is that there are plenty of other science fictional promises that have been fulfilled. Instead, what came to mind this week as I watched the human misery in New Orleans caused by a combination of Hurricane Katrina, incompetence, and poverty, was a deeper, more troubling issue than the accuracy of SF's predictions. No, what bothered me was this. With even today's promises so unevenly distributed, when tomorrow's finally come true, which of us will they be coming true for? William Gibson once wrote that the future is already here, it's just unevenly distributed. But there are more serious consequences to that aphorism than the fact that some of us have broadband while others are stuck with dial-up. Implicit in Gibson's statement is that the present is also unevenly distributed. Forget the spaceships and nuclear-powered communicators. Remember that there are far simpler technologies, ones that many of us take for granted, that might as well be sci-fi to others. What the despair dredged up last week showed was that those with access to cars and credit cards, all 20th century inventions, could at least make an attempt to escape, while those without could not. These disparities seem certain to continue. Free market advocates have long trumpeted that a rising tide lifts all boats, a watery metaphor that is a bit uncomfortable today, considering the circumstances. When the singularity comes, how will we be able to live with ourselves if we leave those metaphorically boatless behind? I still believe in the future, but we must engineer its approach so that its fruits will be shared by all. Humanity has always been separated into the haves and the have-nots. We have just been reminded of the consequences of that. As the promises of science fiction continue to come true, the gap between those two groups will grow even larger. Isn't it about time that we spent as much time and energy solving that problem as we're doing on creating cell phones that will download clips from American Idol even faster for those who can afford them? Because when I finally am flitting through the skies strapped to my personal jetpack, I don't want to be looking down at those living in poverty below. I want us all to be flying high together. That's an editorial by Scott Edelman, who's the executive editor of Science Fiction Weekly at sci-fi.com. That editorial was called The Odds of Being Uneven. Now we're going to listen to a talk given as part of a panel on transhumanism at the Association for Politics and the Life Sciences meetings in Washington, D.C. This is a talk by Larry Arnhart, who teaches political science at Northern Illinois University.
The idea of transhumanism, as you've already heard indicated, is the idea that we might, through the enhancing of human beings, or perhaps the enhancing of the capacities of artificial beings like computers, create a new species of beings that would in fact be transhuman, so superior to human beings that they would constitute a new species of intelligent creatures. So that just as human beings, just as the human species evolved from ancestral species, other primates, and evolved forms of cognition and conduct that made the human species, a distinct human species, superior to those primate ancestors. Likewise, now we have the possibility to artificially, through technology, control human evolution so as to produce a new species of life that we might call transhuman or post-human. Sometimes people use the term transhumanism synonymously with post-humanity, and sometimes people say, well, transhumanity would be the transition between the human and the post-human. But I'll use transhumanism here as just a general term, virtually synonymous with post-humanity. Now, I'm skeptical about the idea of transhumanism. Why am I skeptical? There are at least two questions here. One, can we do it? Two, if we could do it, should we do it? My answer to both questions is no. No, we can't do it. And no, even if we could do it, we shouldn't do it. There it is. You don't need to take any more notes. You know, you've got it. put your pencil away. That's the rest is just fill in, right? Filler. Some of us go to class and the first 5 minutes you exhaust every good idea you have for discussion. And if the students don't talk, you're in trouble and you're trying to drag it out. Well, we'll see. The problem with transhumanism is that it suffers from a Nietzschean extremism. Nietzsche declared in one of his writings, one of the posthumous writings put together under a title called The Will to Power, Nietzsche said that the spell that fights on our behalf, the eye of Venus that charms and blinds even our opponents, is the magic of the extreme, the seduction that everything extreme exercises. We immoralists, we are the most extreme. And I think that quite well captures why Nietzsche is so powerful with people. He's such an extremist. And when people get seduced by the magic of the extreme. The extremism of Nietzsche's immoralism was in his proclaiming that morality could not any longer be rooted in human nature, because in the future, human nature would be transformed, if not abolished altogether. And the consequence of that would be either a collapse down to the level of last man, or an elevation up to the level of superman, ubermensch, or overman. In the debate over transhumanism, the optimist await with hope the coming of the superman, while the pessimist await with fear the coming of the last man. But both sides, both the optimist and the pessimist, have been seduced by Nietzschean prophecies that have no ground in human experience. Nick Bostrom is the co-founder, current chair of the World Transhumanist Association. And he says that his life was transformed at age 15 when he went to a public library and checked out a book and took it home and opened it up. Wow. And it was Nietzsche's Thus Spoke Zarathustra. And here's the music, you know, from 2001, you know. Richard Strauss's Ozzy Sprock Zarathustra playing in the background. His life was never the same again. And transhumanism satisfies that yearning that was cultivated by reading Nietzsche. It's in Thus Spoke Zarathustra that Zarathustra announces that God is dead, but don't worry, good news, human beings are now going to become God, okay, to compensate, because they're going to transform themselves or somehow create the Superman, the Ubermensch. But there is a possibility that the last man might prevail. Like Nietzsche, Bostrom foresees that transformation into the Superman could satisfy the transcendental longings traditionally associated with religion, but without the need for God. So you can have religious feelings without having to believe in God. It's very convenient, because believing in God gives you all kinds of problems. But if you can get the religious feelings without actually believing in God, that's desirable. Bostrom has said, and I'm quoting here, some of the prospects that used to be the exclusive thunder of the religious institutions, such as very long lifespan, unfading bliss, and godlike intelligence, are being discussed by transhumanists as hypothetical future engineering achievements. I mean, he's quite open. This is going to satisfy our religious longings. We get immortality, we get godlike intelligence, we get perpetual bliss. Right? Now, that's the Nietzschean extremism of those who see transhumanism as the way to heaven on earth. Now, by contrast, let's say someone like Frank Fukuyama sees transhumanism as the road to hell on earth. But he agrees with Bostrom about the possibility of transhumanism. That is, Fukuyama is just as much an extremist as Bostrom is, because Fukuyama talks seriously about our post-human future. It's almost inevitable we're going to become post-human, but people like Fukuyama are afraid of it because they're moved by this apocalyptic fear of last man, whereas Bostrom and the transhumanist are elated by the Nietzschean redemptive vision of Superman. Both, I think, are wrong because of their extremism. So Fukuyama worries about a post-human future in which human nature would be abolished. And he says, quoting from Fukuyama, "It may be the case that, as Nietzsche predicted, we are fated to move beyond the moral sense, the natural moral sense. But if so, we need to accept the consequences of the abandonment of natural standards for right and wrong forthrightly and recognize, as Nietzsche did, that this may lead us into territory that many of us don't want to visit." Now, I've never seen any proof in Nietzsche's writing or anywhere else that we are, in fact, fated to move towards the abandonment of natural standards for right and wrong. That Fukuyama's under the same Nietzschean spell as the transhumanists are. And those under that spell see the prospects for transhumanism as confirming this kind of prediction. But my suggestion is that if we could break free of that spell, we could then see that technological changes in human life are not likely to bring radical changes in the human condition. If we could give up both our redemptive hopes and our apocalyptic fears, we could then, I think, begin a more sober deliberation about how we might put our technological capacities into the service of natural human desires. Now, what do I mean by the technical limitations? That is, it's just unlikely that we're going to be able to do this. If we keep in mind the adaptive complexity of human nature, I think we can foresee that the technology for enhancing human powers will be limited, both in its technical means and its moral ends. It'll be limited in its technical means because complex behavioral traits are rooted in the intricate interplay of many genes interacting with developmental contingencies and unique life histories to form brains that constantly change as they respond flexibly to changing circumstances. And for that reason, precise technological manipulation of human nature to enhance desirable traits while avoiding undesirable side effects is going to be very difficult, if not impossible. And then on the other hand, I think that such technology is also going to be limited in its moral ends, because the motivation for technological manipulations are going to come from the same natural desires that have always characterized our human nature. Now, as an example of what I mean by technical limits, and this is just one example, whenever a post-humanist talk about this superhuman, post-human condition, almost invariably one trait is superintelligence. That claim carries with it a lot of extraordinary claims, implicit within it, that is, to think that one could design a super intelligent being assumes that we know what intelligence is in all of its complexity. It assumes that we can reduce intelligence to material causes that then can be technically manipulated in precise ways. And it assumes that we can use this technical power to increase intelligence beyond anything ever achieved by living beings. Now, if we ask transhumanists to justify these extraordinary claims, we get vague assertions. And here I'm going to refer to Mr. Hughes. James Hughes has written a very good book, Citizen Cyborg, and he's right here, so he can respond in the question period. In his new book, Mr. Hughes, for example, in speaking about the possibility of improving computer intelligence, says this, quoting from him, "Since computers powerful enough to model human brains should be common in 30 years, those computer models may then be able to run software simulations of our brains and bodies. Presumably, these backups of our minds, if switched on, would be self-aware and have an independent existence. This is known as uploading." Now, my response is this. Number one, no one knows how to fully model human brains or how to replicate such models in computers. No one knows how brains and bodies could be simulated in computer software. And no one knows how computer software could ever become self-aware. Right? We just don't know that. We don't know it. And yet, Hughes, and typically of the transhumanist, can still imagine a scenario in which all of this ignorance is dispelled based on what he thinks should or may or presumably will happen in 30 years. And sometimes, well, maybe 100 years, or maybe 150 years. Well, but so that's the strategy that I'm questioning, is this should or may, possibly, presumably, sometime in the future, maybe near future, 30 years, right? Though granted, we don't have the faintest idea how to do it now. I mean, that's my reason for skepticism. Now, when Hughes tries to support his scenarios with solid scientific evidence, he reports the research in such a way as to hide many of the problems that would cast doubt on these transhumanist projections for the future. For example, many transhumanists, like Hughes, assume that parents will soon be able to genetically engineer their children to be intellectually superior. And Hughes then cites the research of Robert Plowman, who has, quoting now from Hughes' book, found specific genes on chromosome 4 that only the genius children have, end of quote. And then Hughes concludes that this shows that there are a finite number of genes that determine general intelligence. But if you actually look at Plowman's writings, what you discover is that he admits that he has never found a single gene or set of genes that explains more than a tiny percentage of the variance in intelligence. And he also admits that in some cases, his published announcements of correlations of high intelligence with specific genes have not been replicated, and he's actually withdrawn his conclusions because he himself has been unable to replicate research that would tie, say, maybe 2% of the variance to one particular gene in chromosome 4 or chromosome 6. And consequently, Plowman says in one of his articles, the road ahead will be much more difficult than generally assumed. Right? Because the interaction of the many genes associated with intelligence and the interaction of these genes with the unique environments of each organism have just made it impossible for anyone to clearly identify the genetic basis of intelligence. Now, of course, the transhumanists can always come back and say, oh, well, but it, maybe sometime, presumably in the future, we're going to overcome all these problems. Well, okay, let's wait and see, maybe. But I'm skeptical. Now, it does seem clear that there is much that we can do to develop therapies to treat genetic disorders that result in mental retardation, because many of those disorders are often tied to one or a few deleterious genes that might be subject to some control. It's conceivable, for example, that we might completely eliminate Down syndrome by eliminating the circumstances that would create, you know, that extra 21st chromosome. But although that would be an improvement in human life that, you know, we should promote and celebrate, it would not transcend human nature by moving us towards post-human beings with intelligence beyond anything the world has ever seen. So in that way, I think this technology is going to be very limited. But what's the motivation then for this? Well, surely sometime in the future we might do this. I think the motivation is religious. Now, for example, again, Mr. Hughes, talking about his vision of the future, this transhuman future, speaks of his vision of, quoting now, a society of enlightened beings as an infinite net laced with pearls and gems, each enlightened mind a multicolored twinkle that is reflected in every other jewel. That's religion, right? That, like Nietzsche, the transhumanists profess an atheistic materialism, and yet they still yearn for religious transcendence. And that drives them to project fantasies of overmen, posthumans, who've escaped the limitations of human nature to enter a heavenly realm of pure thought and immortal bliss. Well, I understand that yearning, but I think the best way to satisfy that yearning is with real religion, not with a supposed science of transhumanism. But as I've indicated, I think not only will this technology be limited both in, not only will it be limited in its technical means, it's going to be limited in its moral ends. If we could abolish human nature, what would be the moral grounds for doing that? It's very hard for me to see that once human nature has been abolished, whether there's any ground left for morality. Because if we abolish our natural desires that motivate our thinking and acting, I can't see any ground left for moral judgment. Now, here is where the transhumanist, you know, in some degrees, recognize the problem. It's what happens if we get a post-human, superhuman race that then wants to exploit the unenhanced humans left. And the answer is, oh, well, we'll put a morality chip in. Right? That is, we have to preserve some moral empathy or sympathy so that these superhuman beings would not exploit us or tyrannize over us. But that suggests that there is still some common nature that we would share with these beings, if only moral emotions, moral sympathy, and so on. And that acknowledges the problem, that if you really did abolish human nature, you would have thereby abolished the natural grounds for moral judgment. And I think Nietzsche faced up to that, and that's what the immoralism. That is, the abolition of human nature means immoralism, because morality is rooted in human nature. If you abolish that human nature, then everything's up for grabs. There is no ground for morality anymore. Or each species is going to have its own morality. And so these post-humans, there's no reason to expect that they're going to care about us. Why should they? Unless we could somehow force them to have the morality chips put in their brain. Now, again, assuming that we could get something like a morality chip. And again, I question that on technical grounds. But even if we could get it, you know, how would this work? Now, or another way in which this is expressed is that we should instill human-friendly values in these post-humans. That's Nick Ostrom's phrase, human-friendly values. Well, okay. I think Nietzsche would laugh at that. Human-friendly values. Isn't this nice? You're going to create these superhuman beings, but of course, you've got to instill the human-friendly values. Why? Why would they allow you to instill the human-friendly values? Who are you to impose your human-friendly values on these Ubermenschen? Right? A good Ubermenschen is not going to be disturbed by human-friendly values. But you see, that's the problem. The transhumanists want to create these post-human beings, but oh, wait a minute, but they've got to still have some shared moral ground with us. I can't see how that works. So what is my final stance then on these sort of enhancement technologies? I guess my stance would be a kind of skeptical libertarianism, a libertarian in the sense that, like Ron Bailey, I'd say leave people free to make their choices and by trial and error work through these technological advancements. But with the understanding that they're going to be using those technologies to satisfy the same natural desires that have always motivated human beings, desires for life and health and prosperity and mental equanimity, desires for good children that are well off physically and mentally. And these are the kinds of natural desires that Ron and others assume is going to motivate this technological progress. But my point here is, for reason of being a skeptical libertarian, is that this use of technology is in fact always going to be limited by those natural desires, and it's not going to produce some radical abolition of human nature. Whereas there are times when it looks like libertarians like Ron flirt with the more radical transhumanist position that even the natural desires are going to be eliminated. But then again, I don't see what the moral ground there that is left that allows us to judge this as an enhancement or improvement or progress once that human nature is abolished. But then other times, Ron will say that his liberation biology, as he calls it, is to promote the perfect flourishing of our human nature. Well, I would agree with that. But that suggests that if it's the perfect flourishing of our human nature, which is the ultimate standard, that human nature itself is not going to be abolished. It's still going to be there. And so there'll be improvements in the human condition, but no radical transformation. But then at other places, he seems to accept the transhumanist argument that even the human is just going to disappear. Well, but if the human disappears, then it makes no sense to talk about this technology as justified because it serves the perfect flourishing of our human nature, because that human nature is no longer there. I just don't see what ground is left for judging enhancement, improvement, progress, and so on.
Again, that was a critique of transhumanism by Larry Earnhardt, a professor at Northern Illinois University, speaking at the Association for Politics and the Life Sciences meeting September 1st in Washington, D.C. Next week, we'll be listening to a rebuttal on that same panel by the author Ron Bailey, the author of Liberation Biology, who responds on behalf of transhumanism and generally liberal thought to the critiques articulated there by Larry Earnhardt. So check back next week or listen online to either of these talks at changesurfer.com. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.